I'll continue speaking on Sri Vishnu Sahasranama. Continue means that I've been speaking on this in various places over the last few months. First of all, I'll backtrack to cover the meanings of some names that I recently spoke on, but some meanings that I didn't speak on. The name Avyanga. One meaning of this is that he is not directly described in the six Vedangas. So all the Vedas are to know Krishna, but at least according to this interpretation, he's not direct. Just like the six Vedangas, one of them is Jyotish, which is the study of the planets, their movements, or more correctly, the influence they have, the grahas, the planets that influence, or they demonstrate the what will happen in people's lives. So that study of astronomy is also for calculating auspicious and inauspicious times. There are many purposes to that. So that does not directly describe Krishna, although that is also Krishna's exact time of appearance is also described, and one can also calculate Krishna's birth chart and discover, if you didn't know otherwise, that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was born also, that calculation was done by his maternal grandfather, and it was ascertained by him that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that may describe him, but when that is used, Jyotish, astronomy, astrology, the same word is used for both. When that is used to calculate matters of merely temporal application, then doesn't directly describe Krishna. Or Vyakaran, Chanda, Nirukti, all these different Vedangas. That's one way of saying they do not directly describe him. Of course, for one who has the vision, for one who has transcendental vision, everything directly indicates Krishna, not indirectly. One sees Krishna everywhere and in everything. But the general purpose of the Vedangas, the corollaries to Vedic knowledge, that is not generally understood to directly describe Krishna. Therefore, he is known as Avyanga. Vedanga, the Vedic literatures comprise his instructions. So that's another important meaning. And Kavi means a learned person, a philosopher, and a poet. So Krishna is obviously the most learned person, the best poet, the best philosopher. Kavi is usually used to mean, well, in modern Indian languages, it usually means a poet, not specifically a learned person. But in Vedic culture, a poet doesn't just mean any idiot who just sits down and scrawls something on a piece of paper. But one should be very learned, even to begin to be able to, especially to write in Sanskrit language, because there are many rules, linguistic rules to be followed. And there are also rules of rasa to be understood. So without understanding all this, one cannot be a poet. One has to be very learned. We have in our tradition Krishnadas Kaviraj. Means he's very learned. He's the king of poets, this means. So someone may be very learned. So often we see in the modern age people are very learned, but very dry and boring. No juice. Arasagya Kakchushe, Gana Nimba Fale. Those Krishnadas Kaviraj himself, paraphrasing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, says that persons who have no juice, they're just like crows. And he compares the people who are just interested in dry knowledge, especially impersonalistic knowledge, they're just like crows who they like to eat the bitter fruits of the neem tree. But rasagya kokil kai premamra mukule, that those who are really learned persons who are full of juice, the devotees, they're like the kokil, the cuckoo, who sings very sweetly, whereas the crow, wah, wah, he makes some noise like this. Gah, wah. Whereas the kokil sings very sweetly. So devotees, they sing very sweetly about Krishna. And they're compared to the kokil, which likes to eat the sweet buds of the mango tree. So that comparison is there. So Krishna's Kaviraj, from Chaitanya Charitamrita, we can understand, he's extremely learned. He quotes from so many different shastras. And in a manner that is, his writing is extremely beautiful and pleasing. Poetry, the qualification of poetry is that it should pierce one's heart and make one's head spin. That is poetry. It's not dry technical language. So Krishna, he is the supreme poet and the supreme learned person, in as much as he's given all the Vedic literature, all knowledge. Whatever knowledge anyone has comes from Krishna. Whatever poetic ability has comes from Krishna. And Krishna himself is, to use an English phrase, poetry in motion. His walking is sweet. His laughing is sweet. His crying is sweet. His playing is sweet. Madhuradhipate rakhilam madhuram. Everything about him is very sweet. So he's poetry in motion. That is Krishna. Another important meaning of the name Dharma Dhyaksha, the superintendent of Dharma, just like Yamaraj is called Dharmaraj, because he judges all living beings and gives them the fruit of their activity. So the ultimate judge is Krishna. And Krishna can excuse someone who is meant to go to Yamaraj also, just like Ajamya. The Yamadutas, they couldn't understand, make any sense to them at all, why this Ajamil, he should be released. He had all qualifications for going to hell for a very long time. Being an extremely sinful person. But Krishna decided to excuse him. Why? He chanted my name. How did he chant? In pure love? No, not in pure love, but he chanted. So he should be excused. He wasn't immediately liberated from material existence by chanting the name Narayana, but he was liberated from the clutches of the Yamadutas. So The Yamadutas, they were surprised that Dharmaraj or Yamaraj, he's our boss. And there are certain rules of the universe. So how can anyone go against that? Well, no one goes against it, but Krishna, he has the power to absolve anyone from any amount of sin, just as he likes. So people get the results of their activities under the direction of Yamaraj, but of course Yamaraj is also appointed by Krishna, so Krishna is the ultimate overseer of everything. So, the next name I have to discuss is name 138. So I have to go through 1,000 names. Now I'm on name 138. Think 1,000's a lot? Well, for us it is, but for Krishna, 1,000 names for Krishna, there are actually many, many more. If you wanted to spend your whole life going through all these scriptures and all the writings of the great devotees, you could do, and you would find many thousands of names. Vallabha Acharya, he made a compilation of all the names of Krishna in Srimad Bhagavatam. That's one whole separate book in itself. And many devotees have given names to Krishna. Maybe those names weren't there before. Like Bhaktivinoda Shrai. Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave the name Bhaktivinoda Shrai to Krishna. So there are unlimited names. Krishna has unlimited names. For every devotee, you see, you could say. Just like Bhaktivinoda Shrai. You can be also Bhakti Siddhanta Shrai. Bhaktivedanta Shrai. You can make any number of names. You can make means, not exactly that we make, but those names can be, they're already his names, but we can discover them, so to speak. When Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave the name Bhaktivinoda Shrai, it didn't mean that all of a sudden Krishna became the shelter of Bhaktivinoda. He was already the shelter of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But Bhaktivinoda recognized that by giving that name in his song. So they're like this. There may be unlimited names of Krishna. So 1,000 actually isn't so many. But for us, because we're very small, we think it's a lot. Because you don't have 1,000 names. And you could probably make up 1,000 names, like you could say in Sanskrit, you could make up some name for Rainitai Das, he who drove from Sedona to Tucson. You could make a name like that, and it would be true. But we don't do for everything. In Vedic culture, important people have many names and titles. For instance, Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Ashtotar Sri Srimad A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. That's quite a long name, isn't it? Well, that's a conjunct of several titles, actually. And there's a little difference between a name and a title. Just like there is one citizen of America whose name is Barack Obama, but he also has the title is the President of the United States of America. So if you say Mr. President, or if you say Barack Obama, it refers to the same person. But one is his title and another is his name. So there's a difference. And the title is only a temporary title up until November, and maybe for another 4 years after that also. But Krishna's titles, they're eternal titles. So just like Bhagavan, Ishvara, these are titles of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna, even though it has a meaning, But it's not exactly a position, because no one else has that. Of course, no one else really has the position of Bhagavan, although others may be called Bhagavan. So there's some distinction like that. So anyway, name 138, Krita Krita. Krita means that which is done, and akrita means that which is not done. So this is explained in various ways. One meaning is, he who is the cause and effect of everything. This is a major subject of study in philosophy. Cause and effect. Where did everything come from? That's the important question in philosophy. What is the meaning? What is the why? Why is everything here? How has it come into being? For what purpose? So these are all questions of cause and effect. That which is not done, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it may be a cause of something. And then when something is done, that's an effect. So Krishna is both the cause and the effect, and no effect can develop from a cause without Krishna's sanction. So this is not simply some word jugglery to try to squeeze out a meaning, but these are very important points to understand. Nothing can happen without Krishna's sanction. That doesn't mean that Krishna necessarily approves of everything. Cause of me doing this is because the seat's a little soft and I get a bad back by sitting on soft seats. So that is the cause of my moving, and the effect is that hopefully my back won't be painful. So where did the inspiration come to do that? From Krishna? Now we're talking about that. And the effect of having a bad back, you could say that's also coming from Krishna. But is then Krishna to blame for my suffering? No. I myself am to blame for it, but the mechanism by which it takes place, that is all set up by Krishna. So this is yet another important point, that nothing can happen, not even a blade of grass can move without the sanction of Krishna. But that doesn't mean that Krishna, he wants that there be suffering, but we ourselves create our suffering. He sets up the mechanism for that. And as Dharma Dhyaksha, that name was just given as the Dharma Dhyaksha, he oversees that people get the good and bad results according to what they do. All the mechanism is set up by him. He doesn't want us to suffer. But if we insist on separating ourselves from him, then we must suffer. So he is the another meaning of Krita-Krita. He is the grantor, he grants the fruits, both of this world and of the eternal world. Now, in the eternal world, the Sanatana Dhamma, there is nothing done in the sense that it is done in this world. In this world, there is past, present, and future causes develop into effects, which then become the cause of something else, and in this way there's an ongoing cycle of karmic activity. But in the spiritual world, there is the eternal present, and even though there is activity, but it doesn't cause any karmic effect, nor is anything subject to decline. So, in the sense that actions are performed in this world, that doesn't happen in the spiritual world. Every action in this world has so many effects, but in the spiritual world, there's no diminution of anything. So that is the world where, in one sense, there's no activity in the sense that there is in this world. It's all ananda chinmaya rasa. It is all simply sweet, transcendental bliss, spiritual bliss. There's no need of any philosophy there either. There's only bliss. So that is the world where there is fruit. There is the fruit of love of God, but it is not an effect of any material cause. So Krishna, in this world, he grants the fruits of people's actions, and in the spiritual world, he simply showers his devotees with bliss. Another meaning of krita krita, and there can be many meanings. We're talking about 1,000 names, and each name can have at least 1,000 meanings. So we could be here a long time. We will be. We will. Let us pray to Krishna that we may, for a very long time, for unlimited time, simply glorify him and meditate on his qualities. So, he has the eternal form, and he also has forms which are not always manifested. That's his Nitya Rupa, Krishna, Vishnu, these are eternal forms. And there are some avatars of Vishnu, they are called Naimitic avatars, which means that they're just manifest sometimes, not all the time. An example is Mohini avatar. Sometimes Krishna manifests that form, not all the time. So that's another meaning of that. Another meaning is that he is all that is created and all that is not created. All krita means made, something that is made. And akrita means something that is not made. So this material world is made, it's created, and the spiritual world simply exists. So Krishna is everything that is made and everything that is not made. And that is another meaning of the name krita akrita. That which is done or that which is made, and that which is not done and that which is not made. Then the next name 139, is Chatur Atma. Four Atmas, four beings, four selves. Now one name of Krishna is Advaita. He's just one indivisible person. But he's, even though he is one person, he is Advaitam Achyutam Anadim Anantarupam. He has many forms. Well, he's one, but many also. And specifically here is mentioned that he manifests himself as four forms in relation to this material world: Brahma for creation, Vishnu for maintenance, Rudra or Shiva for destruction. These three are well known as the Trimurti. And the fourth is also mentioned, Janardhan, which is also, of course, a name for Vishnu. But during the period between the destruction of all the cosmic manifestation and the recreation, everything rests in the body of Mahavishnu. And that during that time, then that specific function of holding all the living beings during the period of non-manifestation of the material cosmos, he is known as Janardana. Another meaning of Chaturatma is that he oversees the four states of consciousness, namely the wakeful state, Jagrata, the state of dreams, Swapna, and dreamless deep sleep, Sushupti. So those are three stages. And there's another stage of consciousness called Turiya, which means the state of consciousness beyond any material level of consciousness. And Krishna oversees these four. And there are many fours. There are many ones, twos, threes, fours. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he made what he called Ankavali, which means he made a list of numbers. There's ones and twos and three. Just like three, there's that name is there of Krishna, Triadhish. He's the Lord of three. So what's that? Three modes of material nature, three puris, that means Vrindavan, Mathura, Dwaraka, the three Purusha forms, that's Karna Dakshay Vishnu, Garbha Dakshay Vishnu, Kshira Dakshay Vishnu. So like that, there are many threes, there are many fours, and many fives, and many sixes, like this. So you can find many fours. Shankaracharya, he quotes from the Vishnu Purana that Bhagavan expresses his energies in four forms in each of his acts of creation, protection and maintenance of the universe, and dissolution of the universe. So, the four energies of manifestations of Hari for creation are Brahma, that's clear, Daksha, and others. These are the Prajapatis. Those are the Daksha and others are Prajapatis. That means they bring many, they give forms to many different beings at the time of creation. Another energy of Vishnu for creation is time. And another one is all creatures, because without any living beings, there's no meaning to the creation. Yayedam dharyate jagat. It's the living beings who, for them, the material world is made. So these are the four energies of Hari for creation. For protection, Vishnu, Manu and others, time again in all phases, and again all creatures. And the four energies of Janardhan for dissolution are Rudra, time, the god of death, and all creatures. So in this way the name Chatur Atma is analyzed. The next name, Chaturvyuha. This subject is discussed at some length in Srila Prabhupada's commentary in the Adi Lila, chapter 7. So the Chaturvyuha means the four forms, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna and Aniruddha. And there's the first Chaturvyuha, then another Chaturvyuha. So Vasudev corresponds to Krishna, Sankarshan to Balaram. Pradyumna is the Vasudev is the name by which Krishna is well known in Dwarka. Balaram is well known as Sankarshan in Dwarka Leela. And Pradyumna, the son of Krishna, primary son, and Aniruddha is the prime son of Pradyumna. And they're all Vishnu forms. So Vyuha refers to a form that has a particular purpose associated with it. Pradyumna for creation, Sankarshan for destruction, Aniruddha for protection. Aniruddha means unstoppable. That's, one who cannot be obstructed. Cannot be stopped. So Vishnu oversees creation as Pradyumna, Aniruddha for protection, Sankarshan for destruction, and Vasudeva is the overall leader of all of these. Sankarshan means one who attracts everything toward him. So he oversees the destruction because he draws everything into him at the time of destruction, the cosmic destruction. So name 141, Chaturdangshra, which means four teeth or fangs, like these canine teeth. In English, that's called canine teeth. Some people have very big ones. So, the Sri Vaishnav, the ancient Sri Vaishnav commentator, he points out that to have four such teeth is a Mahapurusha Lakshanam. That is a symptom of a great person. There are certain symptoms of a great person. So one who has prominent canine teeth is... there's a reference to Lord Rama as one who has got four beautiful canine teeth. So that's from Ramayana. So he's known as that. And that's also suggested that Nrsimhadev, he destroyed Hiranyakashipu with his claws, not with his fangs. But lions, they also have dangerous fangs. So the last name we have, Chaturatma, Chaturvyuha. And then one very well or better known name of Vishnu is Chaturbhuja, which means who has four arms. It's a well known name of Vishnu, which carries a conch, disc, lotus, and mace. And these are differently placed. According to the placement, there are 24 Vishnu forms. This is a very common and well-known name. For those of us coming from the Western world, maybe not so much nowadays, because these concepts have arrived in the Western world. But for myself, when I first came to Krishna consciousness to hear that God has four arms seemed something unusual, because we didn't ever conceive of anyone having four arms. Of course, he can have many arms. When he appeared before Daksha Prajapati, he had eight arms. He can manifest any number. But generally, he manifests four arms. And Krishna generally manifests two arms. But especially outside Vrindavan, not in Vrindavan, but outside Vrindavan, Krishna, he often manifests four arms also. According to, usually two arms, but according to necessity or desire, or according to the desire of his devotees who prefer to see him in, those devotees who prefer to see him in an opulent form, who prefer to recognize him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he manifests four arms with those. The lotus and the conch are especially for the pleasure of the devotees. The lotus is the symbol of everything beautiful and auspicious. The conch, well, that's for giving reassurance to the devotees. That it doesn't, it's used in battle also. We find in the Gita that Tatashankascha bhairyascha, that at the beginning of the battle there was the sounding of conches and different kinds of drums, panava, gomukha. Gomukha is another kind of horn. So a big noise was made. It doesn't have any fighting function. Of course, Krishna's conch, but it gives fear. It's supposed to inspire. The blowing of the conch is supposed to inspire one's own army and put fear into the hearts of the others, which is described in Bhagavad Gita. So that's for assuring the devotees of Krishna's protection. And the club and the Sudarshan Chakra, they are directly for chastising the demons. So, Paritranaya Sadhu Nam Vinashaya Chadushkritam. These functions are, that's particularly Vishnu who does that. He destroys the demons. So he has four hands, or as many hands as he likes. But his original form is four-handed. The original form of Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is generally known as Krishna to his devotees. The devotees, they like to see him with two hands. So this is Vishnu Sahasranama, and he's described as having four hands. So that's an important quality. I mean, someone may claim to be God, but they don't have four hands. Someone can make some artificial arms, like Pondraka, but it's simply laughable if they do so. In dramas also, we often see someone will come on with four hands, or in some advertisement, which in India I saw, and someone copied it in the West also. They make a photo of a woman with many hands, and that's supposed to be her kitchen, the mixie they call it. What do they call that? Grinding machine. They're advertising some machine which does so many functions. So they show like this, like some demigoddess. You can do in a photo, but actually they can't do. But Vishnu does. He actually has four hands. So that's very important, isn't it? People call themselves God, but they only have two hands. So if you can't display a universal form, at least show four hands. But that even they cannot do. So what we should do to such people is, this is what Prabhupada said, kick them in the face with boots. Although Srila Prabhupada didn't literally do it, but it would be a kindness to them because they have much worse to suffer for claiming themselves to be God. So, Hare Krishna. That's all I'll say now, unless there are any questions about this. You got your hand like this, you're dreamily looking up here.
I'm trying to put the question.
Okay, well, keep on trying, and in the meantime, I'll address this more positive looking hand up.
Where does Srila Prabhupada get this term,
kicking in the face with boot? As far as I know, that's inspired by Paramatma. I don't think it's a Shastric statement. So far I didn't come across any such statement like that in Shastra. It's not a mental speculation, but as an acharya, he has the right to give some Shastric revelations also, some personal realization. Actually, I had a realization also to add to that. You heard that? Did you hear that lecture? One of my great theological contributions. I thought we can kick them in the face with a boot and make a spiked boot also. How nasty do you want to be? But they're nasty. These Mayavadis, they want to kill Krishna. They want to kill people's spiritual life. They want by word jugglery, they want to send people to hell. And they do it in a very sophisticated sounding way. So this kicking in the face with boot, you may think, well, it's a very nasty thing. But it signifies that people who appear to be very nice, but who speak all kinds of philosophy that leads us away from Krishna, that they're only making an appearance of being nice, and that they are there, such a gross kind of punishment underlines the fact that these people are not, they may appear to be very nice, but they're not nice at all. Just like we have white-collar criminals, who it may appear then they're not as bad as someone who mugs someone in a dark corner and takes their $50 out of their wallet. But actually although they're sophisticated and suave, they can cause far more damage indirectly to... I mean, actually, white-collar crime in terms of actual money stolen or misdirected is far, far more than all the muggers of the world and bank robbers put together. So they may appear to be sophisticated and high class, but they're actually doing more damage than the gross criminals. And what to speak of people who they're not even officially criminals, but they've got the whole system wound up for their own benefit, like these big corporations, and so they're not doing anything literally illegal, but the damage they do to human society and to the whole planet is far more than all the criminals. So that is why I can surmise, as you raised the question, that Srila Prabhupada, he didn't actually do it, and he didn't literally expect his devotees to actually go and kick people in the face with a boot. But he gave that example just to show how actually, although these people may appear very sophisticated, people who say, for instance, that, well, no one can know Bhagavad. I was just reading today one conversation Srila Prabhupada had with some Mayavadis, and they're saying that, well, no one can know Bhagavad Gita. And Srila Prabhupada got very angry with them. He said, why do you say no one can know Bhagavad Gita? You don't know it. But the whole purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to understand it. If you say no one can understand it, that's actually insulting to Krishna. So Prabhupada got very angry with them. You may say, well, they're coming and they're just talking politely. But Prabhupada got very angry with them. Rightly so. Yes, did you formulate your question yet?
Yeah, so I was looking at Lord Ganesh because in the chapter of Buddha, four arms.
Yeah, different demigods can have more than two arms also. Like Ganesh. Ganesh seems to be quite popular around here in this temple, although, you know, when I joined the movement, we hardly ever heard or saw of Ganesh. He was all Krishna. We were dedicated to Krishna. Even Ganesh in traditional Hindu culture, it's just at the beginning of some puja or function. This whole Ganesh worship, that's just a modern invention. Big celebration, so many things, that's all. Lokamanya Tilak has invented all this. Otherwise, it wasn't such a big thing. Yeah, he was a politician. And he invented all this. He promoted this. Otherwise, in Maharashtra, the culture was worship of Vithal, Panduranga. And he brought in all this Ganesh stuff. So even if you want to speak of traditional Hindu culture, they didn't make such a big thing of Ganesh like they do nowadays. Yeah.
Hare Krishna Gurudev. You mentioned that you can imagine God having four arms. So how can we convince people?
How can you convince people? Philosophically, no.
God having four arms?
No, philosophically, no. People have to have some faith. Requires some faith. Some faith that he is beyond our imagination. That we have to accept the descriptions of the Shastras. But these Shastras are not like some Mormon. What's that Mormon book called? The Book of Mormon. Just, you know, someone has some imaginary vision. But they are, that is corroborated by all great personalities since time immemorial. And of course Krishna showed that when he came to this world also. He comes to this world from time to time. Even for that matter, the Quran, it was just what Muhammad said, that God said to him, that's all. There's no corroboration. There's no check and balance system. Whew, you have to be careful what you say. But that, yeah.
Yes, and they also say it was written 40 years after the fact, like the Bible. So some say it was like this, some say it's a different version of the Quran.
Yeah. Prabhupada writes that there are three scriptures of the Yavanas, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. It's not advanced spiritual knowledge. There is actually no spiritual knowledge whatsoever in any of these books, because spiritual knowledge, first of all, we have to understand what spirit is, and they have no idea. That's why they think that you have to bury the body, because the body has to be put back together again. They insist that we are the body. It's all founded on ignorance with some vague idea of God, but that also so vague that it's not even lifted to the mode of goodness. And so in the name of religion you have actually horrible creeds that have been the cause of so much ill motivation and for centuries. So it's amazing that any good, I mean, that people even think of any good at all out of it, because, I mean, there are some good people, but it's largely been a cause of tremendous suffering and continuing in the world today. The religions that demand blind faith because they have no intelligent basis, they must breed fanaticism. Yeah.
But like Prabhupada would make comments about...
Yes, Srila Prabhupada, he didn't make comments like that. That's true. Well, he did in private. But publicly he was quite diplomatic about all this.
Right, that's what I meant. When we go to like that sect of Christianity, Francis?
Yeah. Yeah.
Say, like, you know, they're practicing God conscious.
Yeah. We're not saying there's no God consciousness. But privately, he would make comments like, there's no Christian in the world today. So what I see from our acharyas, they were in some cases quite diplomatic. Publicly, they would encourage and praise the good aspects of certain religions. But privately, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I believe in his Tattva Vivek, in one of he gave a description of Christianity, that God created the world and then someone ate some fruit, and because of that the whole of humanity is suffering, and then God sent his son to die for everyone, and those who believe in this they are saved, and those that don't they are condemned forever. And Bhaktivinoda, he sums it all up by saying that no intelligent person can make head or tail of any of this. In other words, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Although openly he said that we shouldn't criticize others' methods of religion like that. Because, I mean, if you speak to a Christian, they're not going to accept it at all. It's very weak. Generally, they won't accept that. So at least you can encourage, yes, it's nice you believe in God. That you can do. And Prabhupada did that. That discussion with the Franciscans, that was in Australia, and he met one Christian bishop who had actually spoken in favor of the devotees, because the police were all the time arresting the devotees for chanting in the streets. And one bishop had made a comment that actually the police should find some criminals. And, you know, it's like they catch people, or harmless people, who are actually bringing some thought of God into our city. So he spoke in favor, and Prabhupada met that bishop, and Srila Prabhupada suggested to him that, well, if you stop eating meat or stop slaughterhouses. Actually, Prabhupada, he didn't say to stop eating meat for the public. He said you can eat meat, but you have to wait until the animal dies, or you can kill one animal a month if you insist on meat eating. But he was much against slaughterhouses. And if you chant the name of Jesus, and then we can cooperate to spread God consciousness. So like that. Srila Prabhupada was quite diplomatic. But there is... in modern America, among many people, I think we can just openly say that Christianity... I mean, many people feel that themselves, even without us telling them, that they're turned off by this fanaticism and you Bible something, you have to believe or you go to hell. People are very much turned off by that. So, and they're actually turned off from any thought of God whatsoever. So we can tell them that, just like that's described in Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, that Swami Bhaktivedanta came to the Lower East Side to inform people that God is not dead, but he left the church. Or God's propaganda agency, the church, is dead, but God is not dead. So they made some comments, something like that. I can't remember exactly. So there was some comment in some local newspaper, yeah. I can't remember exactly what it is. You can find it like that. His PR agency had screwed it up. Something like that, they said. Yeah, okay. The titles of God as explained to the names of God. Well, I just explained that. Is it, what's unclear about it?
I mean, is it the same spiritual potency?
Well, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has analyzed that there are certain primary names of God, such as Krishna, Govinda, Gopinath, Madan Mohan, and there are secondary names, such as Brahma, Ishvara, and so on. So those secondary names are more like titles. So the primary names, they awaken love of Krishna, Krishna Prema. And the others may do also, but if they're understood in relationship to Krishna. Vraja Prema doesn't come from chanting names like Ishvara. So why are we discussing Vishnu Sahasranam? To appreciate the greatness of Krishna, which is required. You said you had a couple of questions?
And just another question that came up. Ganapati, is that the name of Lord Nrsingadev?
No, Ganapati is generally, it means the same as Ganesh. But that's also a name for Krishna. I mean, all these names, Indra, Chandra, Shiva, they're all ultimately names of Vishnu, but in the material world, they're better known, they're more associated with certain demigods. So Ganapati is a very common name of Ganesh. The other common names, Vinayaka is another common name, which means the leader, but that's ultimately a name of Krishna also. There may be other names also of his. Ekadanta, he only has one tusk. I don't know, I never really studied it, but Ganesh Tattva. Lambodara, he's got a big belly. That's another name of Ganesh. Yeah. Why are these names the most prominent? Well, these names were spoken by Bhishma Dev. Why exactly these names? Well, that's the inspiration that Saraswati gave to Bhishma at that time. He was speaking in front of Krishna. And they certainly cover all the main qualities of Vishnu. Although we don't get names here like Gopinath, Gopal, like that. Specifically names of Vishnu. So Bhishma, he was a devotee of Krishna in the majestic form. Hare Krishna. I'll finish there. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, who has introduced us to all these unlimited topics of glorification of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead.